Aloha. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. This is Catherine Cruz. Today we hear heartfelt perspective from a Palestinian man living here on Oahu as the world reacts to President Trump's suggestion that the U.S. could take over redevelopment of the Gaza Strip. We get the latest from the nonprofit world as organizations strategize how to deal with possible cuts in federal funding. We check in on new goals for solar energy use laid out by Governor Josh Green. How practical are those goals? And we hear from the only drone light show operator in Hawaii and talk about what goes on behind the scenes to make it all happen. It is Wednesday, February 5th. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Ma'an Oda grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp. We caught up with him at a solidarity march last fall as hundreds of people turned out to protest the violence in Gaza. It is a war that broke out after Hamas attacked Israel, killing more than 1,000 people and taking 251 people hostage. This morning, we talked to Oda about the latest development. President Donald Trump is suggesting that some 2 million Palestinians be moved out of Gaza and that the area become a resort development, the Riviera of the Middle East. Oda is a medical professional living here in Honolulu. He still has family in war-torn Gaza. He tells us he now has 42 relatives who have died in the bombings. He appeared to be numb to President Trump's latest statements. You can hear the pain in his heart.
Well, essentially, this is no news to us. The intention behind the Zionist entity has always been to confiscate land and treating our land as a real estate opportunity. To colonialists, that's always been the mentality. How do you exploit and make money off of the land? But to native people like us, we are the land. And so we never see it as a real estate opportunity. We see it as our veins, our arteries. This is how we can grow. This is how we can live. There is no other way for us to survive but the land. So the concept of kicking us away from our land is to detach us from our umbilical cord, to really just kill our only way to survive. And that's never going to happen because it's impossible to erase a population.
Well, when we last talked, it just seems like things have just gone from bad to worse. You know, the death count is just tremendous. And the heartache, you know, families were allowed to go back in to some of those, bombed out areas. But what are you hearing from your family there?
What I'm hearing from my family is truly uplifting, and there's a lot of resilience. But what's underneath that is a really deep sense of, not despair, but sense of frustration at the world, that the world is being so complicit to allow such impunity to happen. And there is nobody allowing to stop or able to stop Israel from committing such crimes internationally, although it's held accountable at the ICC, International Criminal Court, and everywhere else on this planet. More than 120 international organizations have called this a genocide, and yet nothing is being done. So what I'm hearing from my family is this spirit of, while we are resilient, how much more can we take? We've been displaced 8 times in the past 2 years. Imagine you having to take all your belongings and you have to move 8 times. You have no life. You have a family to care for and provide for. You have elderly. You have people with diabetes. You have people with chronic heart conditions. How can they survive these things? They're not allowed to go back. They're not allowed to have access to their medication. All of the hospitals have been bombed, all the universities. So my family is telling me that we actually don't know how we're staying alive. We don't. And I actually don't know either. How are they managing to be able to stay alive?
it must be so hard for you being over here and then, you know, hearing this news and the developments and, you know, watching, you know, the images as well, you know, that are getting out of that area.
Yeah, I mean, hard is an understatement. It's absolutely insane to have to deal with this, with processing the emotions I'm getting from home without having home. Because one thing people need to understand is that when people are going through trauma in Palestine, they're going through it collectively. So while we see so much horror and pain, people are going through it collectively, and that eases some of the pain, that distributes the burden. When you have your neighbor offering your food, if your kitchen has been bombed. I have one of my friends that just told me, literally last night, he told me that he'd been working on cleaning out the rubble from his house the entire day for his family to at least be able to put some mattresses inside and sleep for the night. Obviously, it's all bombed out. There is just the backbone, and it's barely standing. So he told me he'd been working for throughout the night, the whole day. And just around sunset time, he ran out of energy and he started to feel faint and there's no food around. But a neighbor had seen him working all day and had been preparing food for him. And he's brought the food, a plate of lunch or food, whatever it is, it's canned beans, whatever they had. And he had it. And that moment he told me that he realized that through this pain is born a collective sense of unity and beauty that nobody in the world can understand. And so, yeah, it's really hard. But for me here, I'm hearing these news, but, you know, there isn't a community that understands what's going on there. People are either feeling bad or despair, but people that are very, you know, high-spirited and we live collectively as native people and we understand the land and that's how we're able to thrive despite.
Well, I think many of us share your sorrow at the events that have unfolded. And, you know, there is pushback among other nations in that area. They are reacting in disbelief that you would push 2 million people out of that area and develop it into a resort.
You know what's funny is that there, I don't know if you knew this, but there is 50 million tons of rubble in Gaza right now. And it will take, according to a UN report, it's going to take 15 years to clear out the rubble. If 100 trucks have been admitted every single day for the next 15 years to clear out the rubble, which is impossible. So it's estimated that 50 years from now, if we admit one truck every day, we'll be able to clear out that rubble. 100 trucks every day, we'll be able to clear out that rubble. And what that means truly is that that rubble is mixed in with unbombed, unexploded, extremely dangerous substances and toxins and explosive waste that's uninhabitable. People are not supposed to be around this. So they're even going back to that. And they would rather go back to that and live on the unbombed bombs rather than going elsewhere. And that's not because we're not looking for a better life. But the irony there is that what you could fix is don't bomb people in the first place and then offer to take them somewhere else, because people are very connected to their lands. And it's happening everywhere in the world. It's not just in Gaza. Everywhere in the world, the colonialists want to exploit and build real estate and make more money. But we just want to survive and leave us alone. Don't come here and try to invest in our properties because it's a beachfront property. Because we don't look at it the same. We look at it as our food and our source of nutrition and water and everything that we need to survive. So, of course, the nations around Palestine are refusing such unhinged decision by the Trump administration because obviously the Gazans themselves have to determine and they don't want to leave. And second of all, this is about existence. It's not about what's the solution. The only solution forward is to stop bombing civilians, no matter what the excuse, because nothing justifies killing. According to Lancet, one of the most respected journals in the world, the estimate of how many people have died over the past 115 months or so in Gaza is 185,000 people. I don't think anybody on this planet with a right mind can justify that.
Well, there are fears that Trump's wild ideas are going to jeopardize the ceasefire that's in place, and that there may not be the release of other hostages. You know, people, I think, just want the bombing to stop and to see their loved ones, you know, recover.
Right. I think what people, and I hope people can understand this, use your critical thinking. If we want anything as Palestinians for the world to do is use your brain and think. Don't just listen to news and take it for granted. Just critically think about what could be the reason why Trump would say something like this, and what kind of communication had gone between, been established between Netanyahu and Trump to come to this kind of statement. Think, critically think. These people are not here to serve their hostages. They're not here to serve peace. These people want to make more business, to treat a land that's so historically important and wipe out 2 million people after killing 180,000 of them is a strategy that should not be accepted or even tolerated or even excited by the most average of minds. And if you are somebody who still thinks that what has happened over 15 months can be by any means justifiable, then you should check your morality, because I wouldn't want this upon any population on this planet. Let's imagine if the 180,000 people were New Yorkers, people, Americans from New York. If New York was a rubble like this, 50 tons of rubble and unexplosive substances, what would the news be doing? Would they still be asking questions about what could happen, or would they just call it for what it is? This is a genocide. The intent is there. It's been told to us, and we yet have to believe it. And we must believe when the abuser tells you something, you better believe him.
Well, we certainly understand your feelings about this, and we appreciate you spending some time with us to talk about this so that our community hears your voice.
Thank you. No, thanks for the opportunity. And I will say one last quick message. I'll say that it's hard to know what to do, and I don't want you to feel despair if you're listening to this as somebody in America or whatever it is. How can I help? How can I improve the situation? I'm nobody, etc. Please don't think that, because you are everything. You are a taxpayer, and at least what you can do is question where your tax money is going. I don't want you to find for freedom in Palestine or in Congo or in Sudan or in sub-Saharan Africa or whatever it is. This may not be your direct business to be going and marching on the street, carrying a Palestinian flag and chanting Free Palestine. But Palestine is not free because of you at the same time, because of the tax dollars. The only reason why I was born and raised in a refugee camp and the military was able to afford keeping me in a tent and militarizing me and my family is because of American tax dollars. Every tear gas that I've smelled, every bullet that I've seen fired has a U.S. mark on it, made in the U.S. by U.S. tax dollars. And so if you think you don't have much to do, you're wrong. So please do something about it, because your freedom means my freedom.
We have been hearing from Ma'an Oda, a Palestinian activist living here in Hawaii. He was reacting to President Trump's ideas to take over the Gaza Strip and displace millions of Palestinians. The White House press secretary said today that the president has not committed to putting boots on the ground in Gaza.
Elon Musk is unelected, has never been confirmed by the Senate, but he's on the verge of shutting down the U.S. Agency for International Development.
USAID is a ball of worms. There is no apple. And when there is no apple, you've just got to basically get rid of the whole thing.
Musk's power grab, his destruction of U.S. soft power, and USAID's role in national security. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We are digging around our backyard today in search of a tropical tree that is a close relative to breadfruit. Its leaves and fruit may look very similar to the Polynesian ulu, down to the white sticky latex oozing from the skin of super ripe fruit. However, upon second glance, you can spot the differences. Instead of the smooth green exterior of an ulu, the fruit of our mystery species has green, spiky skin. The fruit is also oblong shape compared to the round oval fruit hanging from the breadfruit trees. And the kicker is that when the ripe fruit is cut open, the interior is filled predominantly with seeds rather than the abundance of white, fibrous flesh. Grown as a food crop in parts of West Africa, South and Central America, and the Caribbean, these seeds are edible after cooking, roasted, boiled, canned, or processed in a paste, butter, flour, or oil. The taste of the seed has been compared to chestnuts. For today's quiz, can you tell us the common name of Artocarpus camansi? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Pick up a reusable HBR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for young farmers seeking a future in agriculture, such as the Waianae Community Redevelopment Corporation. NereitHawaii.com.
The Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander Futures Project is a convening of stakeholders around public media and specifically the work that PIC, PIC, or Pacific Islanders in Communications does, uplifting voices across our community. The organization is funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to the tune of $1.8 million a year. PIC will celebrate its 35th anniversary next year. We talked to Executive Director Cheryl Harasa this morning about the uncertainty of federal funding programs under the Trump administration. This weekend, PIC is hosting a Futures Project, which will tackle the underrepresentation of Pacific Islanders and Native Hawaiians in media and to develop a protocol for collecting data from across our community.
So the Futures Project is really just around clarifying what the populist understanding is of Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islander people and culture, because there seems to be a lot of disconnect. You know, there's a hyper visibility, but also invisibility in media. And a lot of times the stories that we see in the media and predominantly in, you know, mass commercial television is not representative. It completely misses the mark from Hollywood movies, which I won't name, to television series that HBO would acquire. So the project is really around what the general public's understanding is of Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders, and then trying to find ways to educate and inform around some of the knowledge gaps.
Well, we are dealing with the disparities, and PIC's mission is really to grow the pool of talent, you know, within our communities across the Pacific.
Yes, absolutely. And not just talent, but the content. And those two go hand in hand. Without the storytellers, I often say that, you know, how would we know about the stories? And so, you know, the project aims to not only help with building capacity within the filmmaking community, but also, you know, ensuring that the content is authentic and engaged in the way that the project aims to clarify misrepresentations and misunderstandings.
And, you know, PIC just was involved in a series of shorts, Homegrown, you know, where you did highlight the experiences of the U.S. territories, right? Virgin Islands, Guam, Northern Mariana Islands, American Samoa, and Puerto Rico. And you don't often get that point of view.
No, absolutely. And a lot of times, you know, not many people really know about the territories. I mean, I can't even count on my hands. It's probably more than I can count on my both hands on how many times that I've heard people from the continent say when they're in Hawaii, going back to the States. So there's also this ignorance, if you will, that Hawaii is a state, but also that there's these territories out in the Pacific, in the Caribbean, you know, that a lot of those stories are heard.
Maybe this will be a good point to share with our listeners about the history of PIC and the fact that you're part of a consortium with other Native groups, right? There's the Black, the Asian, the Native American. Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, so PIC is one of five organizations, distinct organizations, that is part of the public media system. And we're all responsible for ensuring that all voices are heard in the public media system. And so the other four organizations are Center for Asian American Media, Black Public Media, Latino Public Broadcasting, and Vision Maker Media. And so together, all five of us, from time to time, work together and collaborate on projects. And this time for Homegrown, we actually collaborated with Firelight Media, bring those stories of, you know, the territories, including Hawaii, you know, in terms of perspectives from those communities. I should also say that there's another project that we just collaborated on last year, which was called Roots of Comedy. And that was a very different take on looking at different perspectives and hearing from different people in different communities, really looking at how comedy is this doorway to different perspectives and also a different way to address some issues around representation.
And then how are you looking at the climate that we're in? Because the new administration, you know, has not been very friendly to public media, and there is concern about future funding. And PIC and the consortium relies on CPB funds.
Yeah, you know, it is troubling. Definitely, you know, without the funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, none of our work would be able to happen. And so hopefully what we're going to be working on and hopefully make clear is that the stories and the storytellers that we work with through our funding just brings to light American stories. So Pacific Islander stories are American stories. Pacific Islanders have been a fabric of the national cultural landscape for decades. And so it's just really essential that all Americans are aware of what makes this country great in terms of different perspectives and different backgrounds and life lessons.
Well, is there anything that the consortium is doing to either, you know, maybe look at the option of raising outside funds if we're dependent on the federal funding?
Absolutely. You know, and I think that it's always been a goal for PIC since joining PIC a little over 11 years ago. I believe that it's always been a goal for the other National Alliance members to diversify our funding. You know, some organizations have done it more than others. But I think for me, as the executive director of PIC, it's really important to diversify our funding, but also to make sure that the CPB funding is still funding that we can count on, only because of the place or the genesis of the organization. I believe that, you know, CPB was very instrumental in the beginning of PIC. And, you know, public media has always been a part of the organization as a way to uplift Pacific Islander stories and talent. And it's also really important for, you know, the public to understand that this is an investment in making sure that public media represents all of us and stays the only platform that is non-commercial.
Certainly, it's important to have this conversation, and this will be the focus at this forum on Saturday. That was Cheryl Harassa, Executive Director of PIC, who we talked to this morning. The Futures Project event is to be held at 10 a.m. at the Ala Moana Hotel. The public is invited to join the conversation. In full disclosure, I used to serve on the PIC board.
I'm Marco Werman. The world is full of stories.
Israel's never before been in a situation remotely like this.
So they put their hopes in China.
We have a massive aging population here in Europe.
When you arrive in Ghana, then you tell yourself, this is where I should be.
It's 1 hour each day when you get a global perspective. Join us on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits offering workforce housing solutions for young Kama'aina training to become farmers, such as the Waianae Community Redevelopment Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
It's an ambitious goal, 50,000 rooftop solar systems by 2030. Governor Josh Green proposes to do that to move the state along toward its green energy goals. But is it realistic? Here to talk about that is HPR's Sabana Harriman-Pote. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yes, we heard the governor, you know, mention this. So how do we get there?
Yeah, so this came down in an executive order that Governor Josh Green issued last week. And the big headline there was 50,000 new installations by 2030. And when we look at rooftop solar specifically, so not utility-scale solar, it is already an important part of our energy mix. So Hawaiian Electric is getting nearly half of the renewable energy that it uses from rooftop solar systems, and the Kauai Island Utility Cooperative is getting about a third. But to meet that goal of 50,000 new systems in the next 5 years, so 10,000 a year, we would have to pick up the pace on installation. And I spoke to Rocky Mold. He's the head of the Hawaii Solar Energy Association. He says that prior to 2023, we were installing about 2,000 to 3,000 new rooftop solar systems per year. But then in 2023, we saw a jump to over 6,000. And he attributes that jump to a temporary program that Hawaiian Electric rolled out called the Battery Bonus Program. We've talked about that program before. It was meant to incentivize customers to put in solar and storage to help provide energy to the grid, especially after on Oahu we had the closure of our last coal plant. And you could get more than $4,000 up front for putting in solar and storage, as well as monthly bill credits. But last year, Hawaiian Electric replaced that temporary program with a new framework called the Bring Your Own Device Program. And many in the solar industry pushed back against that change, saying that its incentives were just less enticing to customers. But Molt says that the solar industry is working with utilities on possible modifications. The Public Utilities Commission opened a new proceeding, actually New Year's Eve, to tackle this. And there was a tech conference last week as well where folks were trying to figure out the right incentives that they can put in place for customers so we can meet that governor's goal.
To get to 10,000 a year is ambitious, for sure. But we think if we design the programs, again, if we get the right program designs underneath this in terms of grid services, in terms of microgrid services, and and get the right compensation frameworks going, I think it's achievable. And think about it, this goal of adding behind the meter distributed energy resources, most of that investment comes from, from customers and from, their financing of this. So this is really about getting customers and the market to respond to these large policy goals.
You know, I get what he's saying. I mean, full disclosure, my family was an early adopter, and we've got an old battery system that's very old and, almost obsolete right now. But yeah, we had incentives back in the day, and to see that, dwindle, and if we have to upgrade, it's a big investment. It's a lot to pay out.
Absolutely. And Mold also thinks that it's especially important for state and local actors to take action now to put forward these incentives, since Donald Trump has retaken office. And that's brought a lot of confusion over federal funding, which is hitting the clean energy world as well. I know you folks have been following that closely on The Conversation. For instance, some recipients of the Solar for All program, that's a $7 billion program from the Environmental Protection Agency, have reported that they've been locked out of the EPA's online grant management portal that allows them to draw down funding. And that program was designed specifically to help low-income communities access rooftop solar. And the Hawaii Green Infrastructure Authority received $62 million through that program. And I reached out to them to see if they were impacted and haven't heard back yet. But Mold says it's because of that kind of uncertainty that he would like to see the state double down on solar in the face of any possible federal pauses or rollbacks.
We're concerned about, uncertainty at the federal side. We don't know yet what's going to happen. A lot of folks say that the federal investment tax credit under the Inflation Reduction Act is safe because so much of the investment goes in red states as well as blue states, right? So a lot of red states, have benefited the most from the Inflation Reduction Act and federal income tax credits. So folks believe that that might be sort of protection for that. But then you hear something coming down the pike that goes absolutely against that. And I think it's been pretty clear that the new administration has said they're going to focus on fossil fuel investments. So where does that leave solar, and where does that leave renewable energy? We're just not sure yet.
Yes, things seem to be changing from hour to hour. So how else, is this goal of the governor's moving forward?
So in addition to the executive order, both the state Senate and the House have introduced bills that reaffirm that goal of 50,000 new solar installations by 2030 that would enshrine it in statute. But those bills are getting some opposition. So the Kauai Island Utility Cooperative opposes both measures. They say, hey, look, we already have a plan to power Kauai using 100% renewable energy by 2033. That's ahead of the deadlines that have been set to transition us off fossil fuels as a state. And that plan does include more rooftop solar, but it relies more heavily on utility-scale solar projects and biofuels. Kauai says they have more land that they can make use of than Oahu might, and so these provide lower rates to their customers and their members. So they've asked to be exempt from the mandate if the measures move forward. And Hawaiian Electric is also opposed to legislation that sets a goal of 50,000 new rooftop solar units. Yesterday, before the House and Energy and Environmental Protection Committee, HECO's Kaiolani Shinsato said such a measure was unnecessary.
We definitely agree with that goal and the intent behind it, but we did already implement that goal as a part of our climate action plan and integrated grid plan. And I'm happy to say that we are tracking to it, and we definitely plan to, meet it by 2030. So our recommendation is to kind of stick to that path that we've already laid out. And at this time, no need to legislate.
And other parties like the Consumer Advocate and the Environment and Energy Advocacy Group Life of the Land have raised concerns about some of the bill's language about how people who provide energy to the grid through rooftop solar would be compensated for that service. So it proposes compensating those folks for the, quote, full retail rate of electricity that they export to the grid. And that's higher than usual, meaning customers who use that energy may have to pay more. And I talked to Michelangelo with the Division of Consumer Advocacy. He explains that he thinks that that might be an equity issue.
Certainly support adoption of DER. Customers need to have a choice in terms of how they meet their energy needs. And that's one way that they can help reduce their energy costs. I think the concern on the equity side is the value at which customers are compensated for any energy that they provide to the grid. Our position has consistently been that the value that is provided to customers as compensation for anything that they deliver to the grid needs to reflect the value of the service that's provided at that time. So if you're shifting energy from one time in a day to another, it should reflect the cost of generation, because the actual usage-based cost covers a whole many aspects of the cost of delivering service, not just generations.
Yeah, that is an interesting point, because we are going through a shift and save program with Hawaiian Electric right now, and that's being reevaluated. But, you know, the other thing that just popped in my brain is if some of these solar panels are made in China, you know, and then there's the tariff situation that we've got on our hands right now.
Right. That is something that is providing a lot of uncertainty. But the question is, where is the appropriate place to have that conversation? So as we're getting into the nitty gritty of how we pay for solar, how we make sure that it's not too high, not too low to incentivize customers to participate while also allowing customers to afford it. A lot of people who are seeing these bills come up in the legislature are saying, let's leave this to the Public Utilities Commission. This is their deal. They open that new proceeding on December 31st to discuss this. Let's leave it out of the state legislature for now.
All right. Okay, Savannah. Well, we appreciate you tracking these bills, very important bills. Thank you so much. We've been talking to HBR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, and we now go to University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart, who introduces us to a crimson honey creeper in this week's Manu Minute.
The Apapane is a direct descendant of a flock of finches that somehow flew from Asia over nearly 3,000 miles of open ocean and landed in the Hawaiian Islands more than 5 million years ago. It's one of over 55 species of birds, now known as the Hawaiian honey creepers, that evolved from that original group. And nowadays, it's the only one left whose song can still be commonly heard on all the main Hawaiian islands, especially if you're in a forest where the ohia lehua are blooming, as their curved bills and brush-like tongues are perfectly adapted to forage on the nectar of these flowers. Even though apapane are a brilliant bright red in color, they are often more easily detected by their beautiful song, which has recently been found to vary between the islands, and even between different forest patches or kipuka on the same island. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Department of Biology at the University of Hawaii at Hilo.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
On the next Fresh Air, one of Pete Hegseth's first actions as defense secretary was to declare the end of the DEI era. A serious problem the military is facing, though, is a severe shortage of recruits. We'll talk about why, how the military is attempting to reverse the trend, and how vulnerable to attack we've become with Dexter Filkins of The New Yorker. Join us.
beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. Singer-songwriter Judy Collins performs traditional and contemporary folk songs such as Both Sides Now and Send in the Clowns, February 9th. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
And now it's time for the answer to our backyard quiz. This morning we were looking for the common name of Artocarpus camansi, a tropical tree whose seeds have a taste likened to chestnuts. Native to the Philippines and New Guinea, this doppelganger to the ulu was first documented in 1837 by the Spanish friar and botanist Francisco Manuel Blanco while traveling throughout the Philippines. Now, the fruit is very nutritious, but it's an underutilized food source. Commonly, the green immature fruit is treated like a vegetable used in soups and stews. When ripe, the white pulp is discarded and only the seeds are eaten. They can be boiled in salt water, roasted, or steamed. Boiling gives a consistency somewhere along the lines of mashed potatoes. And when roasted, the flavor profile has been compared to chestnuts, coffee, and chocolate. But beware, some people may have a negative digestive reaction. Give up? Well, we're talking about the bread nut. That is the answer for today's quiz. And we had lots of calls, but our winner today, Rick Barboza. And we're wondering if that's our friend Rick, who owns a native plant nursery on the Windward Side. If it is, well, he would know. If you have an idea for another quiz, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, we continue to hear updates on the deadly New Year's Eve fireworks explosion in Aliumanu. Six people have now died, and a total of 10 have been arrested in connection with the blast. The charges include endangering the welfare of a minor and fireworks offenses. We can tell you that on New Year's Eve, there was an alternative to fireworks. There was a drone show at the Kahala Hotel. Tyler Hiranaka is the director of operations at Sky Elements Hawaii. It's said to be the only company in the state that puts on drone light shows. Hiranaka spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the growing demand for these shows in Hawaii.
During COVID, when we took the hiatus, you know, I'm a non-essential worker, so I had some time and I was looking around and I was like, hey, you know, how come nobody in Hawaii is doing drone light shows? Hawaii is a destination. A lot of people want to come here. There's a lot of conferences that come here. And I was just kind of perplexed as why nobody was pursuing it. Got some of my buddies together. Then I said, hey, if we figure out how to do this, would this be something that you guys would be willing to pursue? And yeah, everybody, like Lemmings, decided to jump off the cliff with me, and there we went.
Did you have any experience working in drones or doing drone shows before that?
Not at all. I think the first drone light show I saw on TV was the one by Intel. As they were showing what they could do with their chipsets and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, that is the most coolest, amazing thing that I had ever seen. Videos and pictures can't do them justice. They're just so incredible to watch.
And so what goes into creating a drone show in terms of technology and hardware?
For our Hawaii office, you know, our shows are anywhere in the range of like 50 to 300 plus drones. The shows that we've flown on the mainland have been anywhere from like, I think the biggest one they had was 5,000. They broke a Guinness World Record with flying the largest turkey and like a Santa Claus or something like that, which is really cute. But I like that you ask what goes into the show because a lot of people don't understand, you know. A drone light show business is kind of like a production company / engineering firm. You know, we're like an engineering team with a design and creative team. So on the client-facing side, you know, we go through the process, you know, we mock up a storyboard for them to make sure that the story that we're telling for their event is the one that they want so their audience really can feel the drone light show. The production brings so much value to every show that we do, and they're all custom for our clients. After the storyboard, we mock that up so the client can see, oh, what the animation is going to look like, how the pictures are going to look like in the formation that they have with the number of drones that they're going to use. And then we send that off to our creative team to start animating them. And from there, we use a very specialized software for drone light shows that program each drone position in the path, whether it be flying through the shapes and transitions and things like that. So there's a lot of complexity there. Keeping it simple, you know, it's just a really expensive 3D animation software, which is really awesome. Like technology, even 5 years ago when we started that drone program, was not there. And now, you know, with components being a little bit cheaper, well, not too much cheaper, but more accessible, you know, engineers from around the world have been able to specifically build drones for Drone Light Show. And, you know, thus the software, then all the things that came along with it. So before the show comes, on the development side, there's at least maybe like 80 to 100 plus hours on the design side, because it's like we're making our own short. And then, you know, there's the day of production, huge logistical operation, moving hundreds of drones, sometimes thousands of drones, you know, getting our team together on site. For us, when we go to our production, safety is the biggest concern for us. Technology is great. So we get out there early, we do all of our pre-flight safety checks, we set up our grid, we make sure everything's good to go, we troubleshoot everything before we take flight, and drones go up, drones come back down. So
very much an emerging field. But you said you're the only company that does this here in Hawaii. So why do you think that is?
Well, I can tell you on the economic standpoint, the barrier to entry is quite large. You know, it was impossible to get funding for a new business like that because the technology is so new. Nobody understood what it was. And yeah, it was there's a high barrier to entry, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you make it work?
You know, we had an option to buy a house, and then during the pandemic, we didn't. And, you know, my girlfriend's very patient with me, so bless her soul, now we got drones. But I think it's working out, you know, because, like, what we originally estimated for our projections on how everything would work out financially and economically and just for Hawaii in general, I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity for it, you know. And if people do decide to come into Hawaii for the space, you know, there's a lot of space to grow. Else, you know, my team will happily grow along with the demand should it be there.
And so business has been good so far?
You know, it's, I think any new thing that comes to Hawaii, you know, they always tell us like Hawaii's like the last to figure out the cool stuff. So I wouldn't say that it's been super amazing, but we're definitely on the right track. We have good steady business with our local partners, and, you know, we're getting more local partners and more people that are interested. But I think it's just a matter of time when people see how incredible the shows are. You know, like I said, you really got to go and see one to understand and appreciate the Drone Light Show. It's just incredible every single time.
And so you did a drone show at Megabon, which was a really big festival. Has that been your biggest event so far?
Megabon was a pretty big event. I think for a public audience, that was definitely our biggest event here. But the most impactful show was the show that we worked on with Downtown Athletic Club of Honolulu, with Keith Amamiya and their team over there. We did a drone light show for the Lahaina Luna graduation last year. That show and being at that show and working to produce that show for the community and the kids over there was probably the one of the more incredible things we've ever done, actually. It was just awesome. That show was awesome from start to finish. The goal for that was really just to uplift that community, because as we learned, that particular graduating class, you know, they went into school and then they started with COVID. And then before they went into their senior year, they had the fire over there. So, you know, we had a lot of things based on West Maui, you know, and it was really awesome to do that for them. And surely none of us will ever forget it. It was awesome. The mm-hmm. energy over there that we got from that community is, yeah, it's mm-hmm. pretty awesome.
Yeah. Are there any specific licenses you need to get to operate?
Yeah, there's a lot of compliance that you do have to follow because we're federally regulated by the FAA. So there's different kind of FAA waivers that you can apply for, and we have ours. And also the individual pilots need their Part 107 licenses to, you know, fly the drones. And even each of our drones are uniquely identified, so they're like little airplanes, even though they're just drones.
Oh,
you won't
gosh.
See us flying over New Jersey, promise you that. Yeah, everybody will know when we're up in the sky.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people right now are looking for an alternative to fireworks. But when we're thinking about the relative benefits of drone shows compared to a type of entertainment like fireworks, where do things stand on the environmental side, on the side for pets, for noise pollution, all the things that people complain about?
Yeah, so for Hawaii particularly, though, Hawaii people love fireworks. It's ingrained in our tradition here. We all grew up with it. But drone light shows provide an excellent alternative. When I have to look at forums and they ask me for environmental impact. For me, it's very easy, right? There's no sound pollution. There's no chemical pollution. You know, even our entire operation is contained, so I don't even need access to power. It's interesting to see because when we've been at some of the shows, you know, people ask us, oh, you know, will it affect the animals at the zoo? How about these endangered white terns, you know, or even dogs, right? House pets. So fortunately for us, you know, they're not bothered by any of that. Pets love drones. My dog loves drones. She's a sweetheart. And interesting, you know, one of the things that I actually never really thought about before was the sound pollution with regard to people with PTSD. Mm-hmm. There was one show that we had, our first show out in Hawaii Kai, when somebody mentioned that, and they were actually very concerned. And I let them know, you know, there's actually not going to be any sound pollution, any loud explosions. We're just going to have a speaker set up over here so you can come and listen. And, you know, after the show, she was like, that was awesome. Thank you guys so much. Oh, my gosh. And it's things like that that really keep us and our team going.
So is there anything else that you want to add or plans for the company in this year?
You know, this year, I think we're just plugging along as we can. You know, a big thing that I'd want to get more people to see is just more public displays. Because once you see a drone show, you're going to want a drone show. Like that, I can almost guarantee. Like the first show that we did, I just was looking up at them as they took off and making their formation. I was like, this is just so incredible. And having that production with the audio, it's just, it's crazy to see. It's like seeing something incredible for the first time, but almost every single time. Because for us, we can always change the show, right? It's never the same show twice. So you can have different audio track layered over the creative that you produce with the drones. And it's, yeah, it's like a flying marching band. They can do everything differently every single time.
I love that. That's so nerdy.
Yeah, I mean, I was a huge nerd. I was a huge band geek, actually. My band director out there from Kalani really appreciates me using my marching band knowledge here. Thank you, Mr. K.
Tyler Hironaka, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you guys for having us. And, you know, I'm always happy to share more about what we do. As we go and do more things, I'll invite you guys to the next show.
That was Tyler Hironaka and HPR's Maddie Bender talking about drone light shows as a possible alternative to fireworks. We'll have links to Sky Elements Hawaii, where you can check out some of their light shows, on our website after the show. We're out of time, but up tomorrow, we look at the price of eggs and how local producers are handling the demand. How much do they cost at your local supermarket? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.